heard whispers that the groves were lifeless places now, that only a few of the trees still grew, and that these had been moved for safety's sake to a garden inside the royal palace. Some of the whispers even said that these last trees were dying too. Nisero thought that such a loss would be almost a greater tragedy than the ancient dispossession of her race from the garden, or the evils that mortals had done to them in these new lands. The people still survived, and if they were strong, the Hikideya might last until the world itself was unmade. But with the witchwood gone, there would never be another sacred blade smithed. The great damaged gates of Nakiga would never be properly rebuilt. Old witchwood could not be forged anew. When it was broken, the spells were unbound, and it became no different than any other object of the weary mortal earth. By the second day on the mortal ship, Nisero began to see islands, some little more than clumps of rock that barely pierced the sea swells, others large enough to have vegetation of their own. One cold, windswept atoll was even decorated with wooded hills and a settlement of thatched houses near the shore.
"What people live here, in such a place?"
she asked Mako as they passed it, but the chieftain ignored her.
"Kosi," we called them.
The singer Sao Meji was very close to her, almost beside her ear, and this time she had not heard him approach.
"They are much like the trolls in the eastern mountains, or the mortals of the south, the swamp dwellers."
She wondered why the singer seemed so eager to speak to her. Did he have some interest in her beyond their comradeship, beyond the queen's sacred mission? She was grateful that he was another half-blood, and thus had no right to force her to couple with him as Mako and the others did.
"Yes, they are like the trolls and the savages of the Ran," said Kemi,
a scarred, hard-eyed veteran of the battles for Aswa and the Nakiga Gate.
"They bleed, they die, and someday they and all the rest of the mortals will be scraped from the queen's lands."
He turned and strode away up the deck. The mortal crew hurried to get out of his way. Nisero made to follow him, but Sao Meji moved with graceful precision to block her path.
"We have some time still before we reach the Island of the Bones. The sooner we can perform our task for the mother of all, the happier I will be,"
she said. But for once she was interested in what he said. This was the first time she had heard anything of the nature of their mission, and the name of the island was unfamiliar to her. Sao Meji still had not moved.
"If you would learn more of the Kosi, or anything else of this place in the world, I would be pleased to share my knowledge with you."
"You are kind," she replied, "but I am sure such learning would be beyond me."
Her father had always told her that the followers of Akinabi, Lord of Song, were as deadly and secret as adders, subtle beyond the understanding of the other orders. Everyone in Nakiga knew that the Order of Song was the queen's favorite, its spell wielders and law masters more valued even than the ancient Order of Celebrants or Nisero's own huge and powerful Order of Sacrifice. But Nisero could not imagine exchanging the warrior's way just for power. She had fought too hard in the first place to become not just a sacrifice, but also the first of her kind to be named a queen's talon. Who would exchange such honor for a life of shadows and ugly secrets?
"I am trained only for a single task," she told him, making her voice firm. "To kill the queen's enemies."
Sao Meji may have guessed at her thoughts.
"Do not scorn my knowledge, sacrifice. A sword is no use without a hand to hold it, and a hand no use without the thoughts that guide it. My blood is no more pure than yours, and yet I have risen high already. My presence here shows that I am not scorned by my own order either. Still, I thank you, singer, for enlightening me about the natives.
She inclined her head in the smallest acceptable acknowledgement, then slipped past him. On the fourth day under sail, far out in the stone-grey sea, they reached the largest island they had yet seen. It was topped by a great mountain, the peak a broken cone dusted with snow. A half-dozen or so smaller hills clung to its sides like weary children, all of them blanketed at their bases in mist. Nezeru saw few tall trees, but everywhere that the land had not been cleared, it was covered with green grass and thick undergrowth. A sizable settlement stood on the nearest plateau, several dozen sod-roofed houses surrounded by tiny earthbound clouds that became sheep as Nezeru's ship drew closer, with herds of deer roaming farther up the slopes. Dozens of small, brown-skinned people came down to the water's edge to watch as their ship anchored in the bay. And although the faces were more reserved than joyful, the men, women, and children watched the Hikadeya come ashore without fear. The islanders were small, though not as small as the mortals of the Trollfells. But as if to make up for the sameness of the landscape, they were nearly all dressed in colorful clothing of woven wool and hide. As Marco and the ship's captain walked into the village, the crowd followed them into the center of the cluster of sod houses. When they stopped, an old man in a suit of bead-decorated hides walked slowly out of the largest hut. In one hand he held a scepter made from an antler, in the other a curved bone knife, its surface a crawl with carvings. As he approached, the old man waved these implements in the air and began to speak in a guttural tongue that was like nothing Nezeru had heard. The ship's captain translated for them.
"The elder welcomes you. He says it is an honor to meet the Knowing One's people. They have prepared a feast in your honor. Tonight, you will stay in his lodge, and then climb Go'adi tomorrow."
Marco was expressionless.
"No, tell him we wish to see the bones now."
A little taken aback, the captain translated this to the elder and the other villagers. The old man waved his staff again, this time using it to point toward the towering peak above them.
"He says the shrine is high on Go'adi, and it is almost evening. The paths are too dangerous in darkness. Also, you may frighten the guardians of the shrine by arriving unexpectedly."
"It does not matter," said Marco. "This is what our queen has ordered. Her words are our law. If we cannot reach this place tonight, we will spend the night on the mountain and continue in the morning."
Nezeru did not know whose bones Marco spoke of, or what value there was in seeing them. But as she examined the strange small folk surrounding them, and the exultant, endlessly varied greens of the island's vegetation, she felt an unexpected pride. Who would have dreamed that a mere half-blood child could travel so far from Nakiga and see such things? If she had not followed her heart into the order of sacrifice, she would now be piling stone on dull stone as part of her father's order of builders, or perhaps have become a second wife for one of his underlings. What would High Magister Vieki think now, after trying so hard to keep her from submitting to the order of sacrifice, if he could see his daughter serving the mother of the people here at the farthest edge of the world? Surely he would be ashamed at his own timidity. Surely he would have to admit that his daughter had chosen well. Led by islander guides, They climbed most of the way to the top of the mountain before darkness fell. The villagers who led them were surprised to see the strangers making such fast time. But of course they knew nothing of the training all Queen's Talons received. The nights and days of endless hardship that built upon their natural hardiness and made each of them, even the Whisperer and the Singer, fit and fierce as beasts. When it was too dark to continue, or at least too dark for the mortal guides, Marco commanded them to make camp for the night. As she made a comfortable place for herself against a hummock of grassy ground, in a spot shielded from the worst of the wind, Marco appeared.
I have been looking for you.
But he barely looked at her.
I will couple with you tonight. Await me.
He did as he had promised, coming to her when the moon was high. Nizaru did not feel flattered, but neither could she complain. One of the burdens of her mixed blood was that she was available to pure-blood men, because it was the duty of all Hikadeya to help the race grow so that they would become numerous enough to destroy the queen's enemies and bring harmony to a world badly in need of it. It was even more necessary because pure-blooded women had not made many children with half-blood males, although not, some of the noblemen complained, for lack of trying. Marco made her take off all her clothing before he mounted her. Nizaru did not feel cold, and she certainly was not encumbered by modesty. But she wished he had not ordered it so. A part of her feared being watched by one of the others, especially Saomeji, although she could not say precisely why. If there had been any enjoyment for her in the act, it would have been soured by that discomfort. But in any case, enjoyment was never in view. Her mother, Soja, had once called this intimate connection of two people lovemaking, which Nizaru thought as soft and silly a mortal idea as she had ever heard, as soft and silly as her mother herself could be. Soja had also tried to comfort Nizaru after she had been disciplined by her father. Even when Nizaru herself tried to shrug off the embraces and the pointless apologies. There was nothing of love in what she did with Marco, Nizaru knew. Only duty. But that was more than enough. The Hikadeya were few now. Their mortal enemies were many, and bred like pink frogs, spawning in their thousands every year. Soon the world would be full of them, and the people, and even the garden itself would be forgotten, as if neither had ever existed. Certainly there was nothing unduly affectionate in Marco's treatment of her. His coupling, like his body, was as hard and smooth as witchwood. When he finished, it was in utter silence, and when he rolled off her, it was as though Nizaru herself had suddenly disappeared. Even as she lay in the moon's blue-white light, with his fluids and her own sweat drying on her skin. But she felt she had the right to ask him at least one question.
What, Bones?
He looked at her. His voice told her he had all but forgotten her presence already.
Bones? You told the mortals we came to see the bones.
Marco turned from her.
The queen sent us to find the bones of Hakatri.
For a moment, she could not say why the name sounded so familiar. Then suddenly, and shockingly, it came to her.
Hakatri? Do you truly mean the brother of Inaluki the Storm King? Is there another?
This time, Marco's scorn was unhidden, and he would answer no more questions. 8. A Meeting on Lantern Bridge. The last days of Maris month blew by on cold frost-march winds, as the royal progress made its way north across the plains of Rimmersgard toward Elritzhalla. The journey seemed inchingly slow to Morgan, since the great procession stopped at the landholdings of some of the most powerful nobles, and also in some of the larger cities like High Windy Narved. Each time they did, his grandparents explained the reasons for the visit, anxious for Morgan to learn their statecraft. But each stop seemed so much like all the rest, full of speeches and dull ceremonies, that he lost track. The broad, unfamiliar landscapes and wide sky that had first engrossed him became ordinary and dull as the journey dragged on and on. Even the fair faces of young Rimmersgaard women began to lose interest for him. As Maris passed and Avril blew in, Morgan spent more and more time lost in his own brooding thoughts. Often, lulled into near sleep by the monotony of the spare northern landscapes, he found himself thinking of his dead father, something he had done his best to avoid during the journey, though not all the memories were unhappy ones. A solitary evergreen in an empty waste, bent and shaped by the wind, reminded him of the carefully crafted shapes in the hedge garden back home. And that brought back to him the day when his father had lifted a much smaller Morgan up onto his shoulders so he could see those hedge animals more closely. From his new vantage, they had all seemed more plant than beast, the eyes and mouths so carefully shaped from boxwood branches dissolving into mere whirls of green. But instead of disappointment, Child Morgan had felt exalted. The view from atop his father's shoulders made him feel as though he had suddenly become a man, a tall man, seeing not just the tops of the hedge animals, but over the garden wall into other parts of the Inner Bailey, had given him an exciting sensation of power and possibility.
"Someday I will be this big," he had thought. "Someday I will be able to go anywhere." "Take me outside, Papa," he had demanded. "Take me out. I want to see if I'm as tall as the castle walls."
His father had laughed, enjoying his excitement, and then carried him to the massive old festival oak at the garden's far end to let him feel its centuried bark, so covered with cracks and bumps that the young Morgan could imagine it was a dragon's armored skin. But that had been before Prince John Joshua had lost interest in his wife and young son, before he had become so immersed in his old books and his writing that he scarcely joined Morgan and his mother even for meals. Even when he was with them in those later days, he had seemed always to be thinking about something or somewhere quite different. It was hard to mourn the way his grandparents did, with careful conversations and quiet ceremonies. Morgan felt his father had left him years before he died. Now that they had reached the hilltop, Simon and the rest of the mounted company could look down the river's course and see almost the whole of the Drawshul Valley. Even several days into Avril, snow was still piled so thickly that in many places everything but village and farmstead roofs were buried. Even the church spires that marked out each settlement seemed to be standing on tiptoe.
"Look," said Morgan, pointing. "Is that it?"
The Royal Progress had been following the course of the river for several chilly days, through cold rains and painful flights of gravelly sleet. But it seemed they had finally reached their destination, a huge walled city at the far end of the valley where the Gratovask split into two channels. Set on the peak at its center was a keep surrounded by four stocky towers, each crowned with a steep conical roof.
"Alrit's Hall," Simon said. "Praise God, we finally arrived. I haven't seen the place for so long."
Even so early in the grey afternoon, the city smouldered with lights, like a field of live coals.
"What are those other lights, Grandfather?" Morgan asked. "The ones stretching over the river?"
"That is the Lichtenspan, Lantern Bridge in Westerling," the king explained. "The lanterns are hung along its whole length. Most of the time they are lit at sunset each evening, and extinguished when the sun rises. But it looks like they've lit them early today. Perhaps because of us."
"I would not be surprised," Miriamel said. "We are the High Throne after all. It is not as though we visit every sennight."
"It's a very nice bridge,"
Morgan said dutifully. But Simon thought it a poor compliment. He had loved the Lichtenspan since the first time he had seen it. The distant rows of lights always seemed to float above the river, like something magical. "Did you know," he told his grandson, "that there are times in winter when the lanterns burn for days straight, because the sun never rises?" He frowned at Morgan's dubious look. "Don't scoff, lad, it's the truth. In summer, it is the opposite. The sun stays in the sky for days." Morgan was obviously doing his best to stay on his elder's good sides, but his youthful pride, just as obviously, made him fear being the butt of some hoary old joke. "Is that really true, grandmother?" he called to the queen. "Unlike some of the things your grandfather says, yes, it actually is. Duchess Gutrun used to speak of how the winter made her fret, because it felt as though the sun had actually gone away for good. But do not ask me why such a thing should be."
"It is because the vault of the sky is curved, I think," Simon said. "Something of that sort. Morgainis once explained it to me."
"Ask Lord Tiamak," the queen suggested. "He doubtless has learned something from his many books that can explain it, Morgan."
"I will, grandmother."
But the prince could not hide his lack of enthusiasm at the prospect of being lectured on the workings of the firmament, and Simon felt a prickle of irritation. What did it take to engage the lad? Morgan would inherit the rule of this land and most of the known world, yet he acted as though it were all some unwanted chore. It was hard for Simon not to blame Merry. She was always worrying about their grandson, trying to protect him from his own mistakes. He certainly understood why. How could he not? After the terrible loss she had suffered, they all had suffered. But protecting the boy from the consequences of his mistakes seemed like the wrong idea.
"Yes, he lost his father, but I lost both my mother and father before I was born, and I had no loving grandparents, no younger sister, none of the things that Morgan has. I had blistered hands from hard work in the kitchen, and I had Rachel the dragon pinching my ears. Would the boy trade his condition for mine?"
Simon took a breath.
"It would not harm you to learn a bit more about the history of the nations under our high throne," he began.
But Morgan saw his direction and changed the subject.
"Why is the bridge so high over the river? I've never seen a bridge so tall."
Simon had to admit it was a sensible question, and his annoyance faded. His grandson was no fool, at least. The Lichtenspan was set on a row of tall stone arches, so that it stood far above even the leaping froth thrown up by the turbulent river.
"That's because when the spring thaws come, the Gratovask climbs over its banks and rises a man's height or more, and stays there for weeks," Simon explained. "The water rushes down from the mountain so fast that it's full of white foam and cold. I remember Isgrimnor talking about it. 'It isn't water, it's melted ice,' he used to say. And it hasn't melted much."
He laughed. Morgan had an unusual expression on his face, as though he was doing his best to understand a new idea.
"You and Grandmother talk about the Duke very often, Grandfather. You must have loved him. I'm sorry I never knew him."
Simon was a bit surprised by Morgan's words, worried that they were meant only as distraction. But after a moment he nodded and smiled.
"Duke Isgrimnor was a great man," he said,
then corrected himself.
"He is a great man,
and we may yet greet him before this day is over.
Isgrimnor is the best friend Erkinland and the High Ward ever had. A man who saved my life and your grandmother's life many times over. I have prayed God would let him see you once more, now that you are grown. And not just because you will inherit the High Ward from us one day and rule over his people. It would mean much to the Queen and to me if that good old fellow could give you his blessing."
The perpetual rush and roar of the river filled their ears as they followed its course along the floor of the valley. Past tidy farms and prosperous villages, all but hidden under snow. In places the drifts were still piled so high that the houses were marked only by the smoke wafting from their chimneys. Morgan seemed to be enjoying the sights, but Miriamel just wanted the ride to end, in part to escape the cold, but in the largest part because she desperately wanted to see beloved Iskrimnor still alive. The prince seemed most impressed by the house-sized chunks of ice floating past them down the churning, fast-moving Gratuvask. Mary could not help smiling at the look of wonder on Morgan's face, and remembered her husband at a similar age, a kitchen boy, seeing things that even the hardiest travellers had never experienced. The Scythe's beautiful ruined city of Dai Jakiza, the great stone pillar of Seswadra. He had even fought a dragon, like someone in an old story. He might not want to speak of it now, might feel some strange modesty, but that did not change the fact that the king was no ordinary man. Even in his middle age, Simon still stood almost 2 hands taller than Morgan. But Mary thought they were more alike than not. Stubbornness? Morgan had inherited a full measure of it from Simon. But as her husband liked to point out, Miriamel was no sapling bending to the wind herself. And of course, trying to get Morgan's father, John Joshua, to do anything he hadn't wanted to do, had been like trying to pull a badger out of its den. And Morgan's mother, Idela, was not much more tractable, although she pretended to be. No. If she was going to be fair, the queen had to admit that Morgan's stubbornness was a family affair, generations in the making. For a moment, as she watched them silhouetted against the lights of the bridge, Miri could picture her husband and grandson as the wings of a triptych, like the life of Usiris that stood behind the altar in the royal chapel at home. There, on one side, was Simon the Patriarch, tall, with grey in his red beard. On the other stood Morgan, his descendant, still callow enough to think drinking and womanizing was proof of something other than drinking and womanizing. But the centre panel was missing, that which should have been her son, John Joshua, and which should have united the two on either side. Her child, her beautiful child, who had grown to be such a tall, clever young man, was now only a shadow, even to his own children. His death had left a hole in their lives that could never be filled, no matter how she and the rest of the family pretended. Her heart aching again, she tried to pray, but her own measure of the family obstinacy rose up and thwarted her. No matter what the priests claimed, how could such a loss be God's will? Why had the Creator, whom Miriamel had always tried to serve, stolen her only child? The royal progress had dispatched riders to alert the city to their approach. They had disappeared across the bridge and into the shadow of the gates more than an hour before, but still had not come back. Miriamel was beginning to wonder if something had gone wrong. She couldn't imagine what the problem might be. Thanks to the old Duke, Rimmersgaard was the High Ward's most faithful ally. It seemed unlikely they would suffer the same kind of problems that had plagued the Hernesteer visit.
"Ah, look there," Morgan announced. "Someone is riding toward us. See, he has just mounted the bridge from the far side."
Simon squinted.
"Oh, to have young eyes again. Is it one of our messengers?"
Morgan shook his head.
"Too far away to tell, but I don't think so. Something odd about the rider. Still, there is only one."
"Odd?"
"I can't say more yet, Grandfather. May I ride forward to get a better look?"
"No," said Miriamel firmly.
"No, Morgan, you may not."
Simon gave her a look full of unspoken meaning. He thought she was being too cautious, she could tell.
"I think he might, with the Queen's permission, of course, but only if he takes a troop of the Erkin Guard with him. Remember, Morgan,
These are some of our oldest allies, and we have no reason to doubt their goodwill.
What if something happens to him? Miriamel demanded. He is our heir.
What if we all die in our beds from the Red Ruin? What if we are struck by lightning? The king realized he had become loud and lowered his voice.
Be fair, Miri.
When people told you to hold back, to do nothing dangerous, what did you do, my love? Rode off into the night on your own, with nobody but a thieving monk for a companion. She did her best to push down unqueenly anger.
Are we not allowed to learn anything from our own mistakes, then? Should we let our children and grandchildren make the same errors without saying a word?
Making those errors may be the only way they will learn the lessons we did, my dear one, Simon said. Certainly for all Morghenis or Rachel tried to teach me. It never quite made sense until I had ignored their good advice and done something impressively stupid instead. He put on his most innocently harmless face.
Come now, wife. Let Prince Morgan ride out with the Erkingard to find out who is coming to meet us.
As was often the case, Miri found herself caught between wanting to kiss her husband and briskly rattle his pate. Instead, she shot him a look that made it clear the larger discussion had not ended, but at last gave her reluctant consent. While Morgan was gathering an escort of Erkingards, Simon called for Renan, the minstrel. Ever since he had scolded the young harper some days earlier, her husband had gone out of his way to be kind to him. When at last the musician was located, he looked anxious as a cat in a room full of drunken dancers.
Majesty?
I want you to ride with me, Harper, the king told him. Somebody find this lad a horse.
Of course, Majesty. I would be honored.
You are not still frightened of me from the other day, are you? Simon shook his head.
Don't be. I need your help. Majesty?
You really need to think of something new to say, son. And you can leave that stringed thing hanging on your back. I don't want your music. I want your eyes. He saw the startled look. Good God, I'm not going to take them from you.
I want you to see what I can't from this distance, with evening coming down. Yes, Majesty.
Morgan and his Erkingard escort rode out, and soon reached the beginning of the Lichtenspan while the Queen and King watched. At the center of the bridge, a dark shape was moving toward them, though at such a distance, Miri could make out little more than a blot of moving shadow.
What do you see, Harper? The king demanded. By the tree, lad, talk to me!
For a moment, the young minstrel only narrowed his eyes and leaned forward.
The rider from Elvritshala, he said at last, is... Well, there is something strange about him, Majesty.
People keep saying that. What in the name of blessed Saint Sutrin does that mean? Strange how?
Miri was amused, despite herself.
You really must calm yourself, husband. Let the poor man answer you.
Simon scowled.
Go on, then. What do you see?
The harper was still squinting.
He is quite small, I think. Now that our soldiers and the prince are getting closer. Yes, he is small and...
Renan licked his lips.
Majesty, I swear to you, that is no horse he is riding. It looks... It is hard to make out, but I would swear...
He turned to the king and queen with a look of shame and guilt.
Majesties, please do not punish me, but I think that the one coming from Elvritshala is riding some kind of dog.
The king was not a violent man, although over the years he had broken a few things in his angriest moments, as the servants in the hayhold could attest. But Miri knew he had never struck and never would strike one of his subjects. Still, when King Simon swore in loud astonishment, she saw young Renan brace himself for the blow he must have felt sure was following such a ridiculous pronouncement. But the harper looked even more surprised when his liege lord suddenly spurred his horse toward the bridge as though leading a battle charge, leaving the queen and the harper to watch him go. Several of the Erkengard even cried out in surprise, but when they would have pursued Simon, Miri lifted her hand to hold them back. As the echo of hoofbeats faded, Rhiannon turned to the queen.
"Majesty," he managed at last, "did I do wrong, Majesty? I beg your pardon. Forgive me, my queen, but what just happened? Is the king angry?"
She smiled.
"Oh, do not fear, young man. All of that was nothing to do with you. He is hurrying to meet an old friend."
Morgan and his guardsmen had just reined up their mounts, filled with surprise and not a little superstitious dismay at the apparition before them, when they heard the clatter of hooves coming up the stone bridge behind them. Already unnerved by the odd little man riding toward them on a huge white wolf, the sound of swift pursuit startled Morgan's horse so badly that he had to fight to stay in the saddle. His balance finally regained, he yanked his sword out of its scabbard, wondering if he would now have to fight to the death like some ancient hero. Caught up in the moment, several of the Erkengard drew their blades as well.
"Put up!" someone shouted. "Put up your blades! It is the king coming!"
The wedge of men on the bridge milled in confusion as they struggled to make a way between them for their fast-moving monarch. Morgan could only watch as King Simon, standing in his stirrups, grey-shot red hair flying, sped through their midst. He scarcely glanced at Morgan as he careened past.
"Grandfather!" Morgan called. "Majesty!"
But both the king and the wolf-riding apparition had stopped in the middle of the bridge and were climbing down from their mounts, paying attention to nobody but each other.
"Benabek!"
his grandfather shouted, then pulled the small figure into his arms like a father whose child has been returned to him after a long, frightening absence.
"Friend Simon!"
cried the little man, who was scarcely higher than the king's waist, and then laughed as the king whirled him around so violently that Morgan was frightened they both might tumble off the bridge into the freezing Gratovask. The prince spurred his horse forward, partly to be sure they stayed on the bridge, partly to better make sense of what was happening. Clearly, this must be his grandfather's troll friend, a nearly legendary character.
"My people are saying that to meet an old friend is like the finding of a welcoming campfire in the dark,"
the little man said, slightly breathless from the king's powerful embrace.
"Just the sight of your face warms me, Simon."
"It is wonderful to see you, Benabek," Simon said happily, finally setting him down. "But why have only you come out to greet us?"
"In Elvitzhalla, the spools and cranks of the Frostmarch gate somehow are not working to open it. A great many horses and riders are there waiting to honor you, but they are being caught on the far side. Only noble Vakana and I were small enough for squeezing through."
He patted the monstrously large wolf, a creature of shaggy, spotless white, who seemed utterly at ease with the humans that surrounded her, although the same could not be said for most of those humans.
"But have no fearfulness, old friend," Benabek said. "I think they will be repairing it by the time your people are reaching there. Where is Miriamel, your beloved? She is well, I am hoping?"
"She's back there on the bridge, clucking her tongue at me for riding off like a madman," said the king, smiling so broadly that Morgan thought he looked demented. "Ah, but it is good to see you."
Simon looked at the wolf, now seated and calmly grooming. "And you said this was..."
"Vakana, ever loyal," said the troll. "Yes, one of noble Kantaka's descendants she is being. And it is so very good to be seeing you too, friend Simon, after too many years."
Benabek grabbed a thick tuft of snowy fur and climbed onto the wolf's broad back.
which bore it with the patience of long experience. At last the small man noticed Morgan.
Ha! I think I am seeing a face that is now much changed from my first seeing of it. Is this truly being your grandchild?
King Simon smiled and nodded. For a moment Morgan could almost convince himself his grandfather looked proud. Yes, indeed. I'm sure he does look a bit different. This is Prince Morgan, our grandson and heir.
Look at him, a grown man, crowed the troll. As we also say on Minterhawk, Hanna aya mo sik sik, chaho naha, as easily be trying to catch an avalanche in a thimble as to make the season stand still.
The king turned to his grandson. Morgan, this is Binnebik of Yikanuk, my dearest friend. You have not seen him since you were a child, more than 10 years ago. Do you remember? Morgan was about to say no, but then a scrap of memory fluttered up. A group of small men and women, and Morgan himself brought to meet them. He had seen dwarves at the court many times, but these had been something different, with dark, serious faces and strange clothes, and they had frightened him. A little, I think. Well, you will meet no better man in all Ostenard, of any height. The king seemed happier than Morgan had seen him in a long while. And your good lady wife, Binnebik? She is well. And your child?
Both are being well, and both are also being with me. But the girl has been growing from child to woman, and she has brought her Nokapik, her marrying friend. We all were riding here together, the others on their rams, myself on board Vakana.
As he scratched behind the wolf's ears, Binnebik's brown face creased into a broad smile, surrounded by wrinkles that showed it was a frequent expression for him.
You will see them all tonight, I am thinking. Well, perhaps not the rams, who will be resting and eating.
And how is Iskrimnor?
The Duke still is alive, praise to Seta, our dark mother. But he is very old, and his weakness is growing. Still, he will be pleased to see you, friend Simon, so very pleased.
At that moment, Morgan was startled again by a screech from somewhere at the other end of Lantern Bridge, near the walls of Elritzhalla. His horse was startled too and had to be calmed.
And that, if I am making a good guess, said Binnebik, is the sound of the city's Frostmarch gate being at last opened. Come, Simon King, and almost grown Morgan Prince, is Grimnor's son Grimbrand, and the Duke's subjects have all come out for welcoming you. It was only that I was slipping out first and spoiling their plan. Come!
Morgan was quite happy to be out of the cold Frostmarch winds at last, and inside the city walls. All of Elritzhalla seemed to have lined the streets to see the royal party enter, or at least lined the main road between the gates and the Duke's palace, atop the stony hill at the center of the city. People shouted and waved torches and lanterns. Others hung from upper floor windows, and despite the late hour, all cheered loudly as King Simon and Queen Miriamel rode by, as if the high monarchs had come to make their dying duke well again. No one seemed to recognize Morgan himself, but the prince was not too unhappy about that. He had worked hard to please his grandparents of late, but the last thing he wanted was to be dragged into more of the endless rituals and court functions that would fill the next few days. He wanted instead to find Astrian and the rest as soon as possible, then find a place to drink, some warm, dark refuge hidden away from the numbing boredom of official life. As he observed the mostly fair-skinned citizens of Elritzhalla,
He noted more than a few young women, as tall and comely as anything that even Urchester, capital city of the High Ward, had to offer. Many of them with hair as golden as a shiny, unspent coin. He had believed he was weary of northern girls, but suddenly he felt less certain. In fact, Morgan was beginning to look forward to conversing with some of the Duke's young female subjects.
"My subjects too, some day," he thought suddenly, "when I am king."
It was a strange but interesting thing to consider.
"There you are, my prince." Sir Porter rode up beside him.
The old knight had a scarf wrapped around his throat and lower face, as if he had ridden through a howling blizzard.
"It is good to be here, yes. I have not seen the place for many years. Not since the days after the siege, when we came this way with Duke Scrymnor."
"And I have heard that story so many times, I could tell it myself and be no less truthful than you," said Morgan. "More so, probably, since according to Astrian, half your tale is invented and the rest is exaggeration."
Porto gave him a hurt look.
"The Nabon man knows nothing about it, and only seeks to tease me. He was a suckling babe in his mother's arms when I fought the Norns."
Morgan grinned.
"To be quite honest with you, it is not fighting Norns I want to know about just now, you old villain. Where does one go to find a decent spot for drinking and singing, and not having to put up with all the nonsense that my grandparents came for?"
Astrian rode up, looking as well turned out as if he had just set forth, instead of having suffered the same long ride as the rest of the company.
"My prince, I was afraid you had already gone with your family to the castle."
"I'm trying to get Porto to tell me where the good spots in this city are, since he claims to have been here before."
"Claims?"
Porto lifted himself to his full height in the saddle, which made him look like a stork trying to take off from a chimney nest.
"I promise you that even after so many years they will not have forgot Porto Vansis Pelepe in the better taverns of the Kopstade."
"Now we are getting somewhere," said Morgan. "What is this Kopstade?"
"The market and its surroundings," the old knight said. "We have passed it already, Highness. It was near the gates."
"Then let's turn back."
"My prince, I think not."
Unusually, it was Astrian preaching moderation.
"Not tonight, at least. You'll be expected to partake in at least a few formalities with your grandparents. The old duke, all of that."
He waved his hand in a vague way.
"No!"
Morgan realized he had almost shouted it. He could feel himself reddening.
"No! I don't need to watch some old man die. It's none of my business. He's my grandparents' friend."
Astrian shrugged.
"As you wish. But at the very least, Highness, you must find out where you are to be housed before you spend an evening out. Alvritsala Castle is not a small place. You'll need to know how to find your way to wherever you will be sleeping."
"Sleeping? Who wants to sleep?"
Morgan gave him a bitter look.
"It is cruel to break my heart this way, Astrian, and I certainly didn't expect it of you. All I want is a tankard of beer and a bit of a laugh."
"Still, Highness, it was you who warned us your grandparents were angry with you."
Astrian looked up as Alvaris approached, guiding his warhorse through the procession that crowded the wide road.
"Come help me, my friend," Astrian called to him. "I'm trying to convince our good prince that this first night, at least, he must appear to honor the king's and queen's wishes."
Alvaris made a face.
"Astrian calls for good behavior? We clearly have taken a wrong road and wound up in the land of faery." "Do not make such a jest," said Porto, alarmed. "Not here in the north. Because the fairies are closer and fiercer than you think. In the morning you will be able to see Storm Spike Mountain in the distance.
As long as it stays distant, said Morgan. It was coincidence, of course, but just as the prince finished speaking, a cold wind blew down the street, whipping the banners on the houses, making Morgan shiver even through his armor and surcoat.
It is a pleasure to see you again, Siski Nanamook,
Miriamel said as they stood together around the fireplace in a low-ceilinged but sumptuous antechamber in the ducal residence. Simon knew that after weeks of repeating these words across the length and breadth of Hernesteer and Rimmersgaard, this time she truly meant them. Mary had always been fond of Benedict's wife, since the days they had all fought together. Siski bowed her head, clearly pleased to hear Miriamel use her full name.
As it is for seeing you, great queen.
Mary waved the title away.
You came all the way from your mountains to see us, Grimnor? Bless you.
We could not be doing other, Benedict said. The best Rimmer's man we ever had the luck of knowing.
Mary smiled at that.
And Simon says your daughter is here in Elritzhala, too. I so look forward to seeing her. She must be a grown woman now.
Siski smiled.
Grown is Kina, yes, and here with her man, too.
Is she married? Simon asked.
Soon, said Benedict. When again they reach Mintahok, Kina and Snenek will go together to Chitsik up Lingit. Do you remember that place, friend Simon, where you once were pleading to Siski's parents for sparing my life? And then they will bind together their hands before the ancestors and our people.
The door to the Duke's chamber swung open, and Grimbrand came out to greet them. With his dark hair and his broad face and figure, Simon thought he looked more like his father than his older brother Isorn ever had. Still, it was strange to see how much grey and white now flecked Grimbrand's beard.
By the Ransomer's Tree, when did we all grow so old?
Grimbrand had been too young to fight in the Storm King's War, and had spent the time of his family's exile with relatives. He had grown into a just and thoughtful man, who possessed many of his father's best traits. It was good to know that at least one of the lands of the High Ward would be in good hands.
He has just woken up, Majesties.
Grimbrand's smile was weary.
I think if you all go in at once, it might be too much. May I take the High King and High Queen first?
Simon turned to Benedict.
With certainness, said the small man, smiling. Go in.
Tiamat should be here too, said Miriamel. He and the Duke love each other well, but he is still searching for our grandson, Prince Morgan.
Come then, said Grimbrand. The others can join you shortly. And if your grandson's absence is anything serious, I will send men to look.
Oh, please don't, said Miriamel hurriedly. I'm certain we will find him quickly enough.
As you wish, Majesty. Grimbrand beckoned them toward the door.
The Duke's chamber was much as Simon remembered from his last visit, 10 years ago or more, still kept as a sort of shrine to his Grimnor's beloved wife, Gutrun. Grimbrand's mother. Candles burned everywhere, but especially on a low table in front of a painted portrait of her. Her chair and her sewing chest still sat beside the room's largest window, which to Simon's surprise stood open. The Rimmersfolk did not seem to mind an airiness that would have terrified Erkinlanders. At the center of the room, the canopy of the huge bed fluttered in the night air. Simon could not help thinking of a ship drifting out to sea, its sails filling with wind.
But the Rimmer's men no longer take to the waves, Simon remembered.
Two priests who had been praying at the foot of the bed rose and left the room. For a moment,
as he and Miriamel approached the bedside. Simon was confused. Surely this sleeping stranger could not be Iskrimnor? It wasn't possible that this old man propped on the pillows, unable to hold his head up, was their friend the Duke, one of the largest and strongest men Simon had ever known. This almost stranger's cheeks were sunken, his hair and beard snow-white and sparse, and his neck seemed far too frail to have ever lifted a head as noble as Iskrimnor's. The old man's eyes fluttered open. For a moment they could not seem to fix on anything, and roved from the ceiling to the walls. Grimbrand stepped forward and kneeled beside him.
Is that you, Isson?
The voice was a ragged ghost of the Duke's booming tones. Simon guessed that Grimbrand had been called by his dead brother's name many times in the last months, because he did not bother to correct his father.
Sire, some friends of yours are here to see you.
Queen Miriamel and King Simon have come all the way from Erkinland.
And now the rolling eyes touched Simon's, and the man inside the worn, spent body seemed finally to take control. Iskrimnor frowned, squinted, and then his eyes opened wide.
By the good God, it is you.
His gaze slid to Miriamel and he smiled.
You have both come. God bless you and keep you. Come, give me your hands. We'll not meet again on this earth, I fear. So give me your hands.
Simon and Miriamel each moved to one side of the bed, and each took one of the Duke's hands. Simon, whose eyes were already filling and threatening to overspill, thought the old man's bones felt fragile, like eggshells.
Of course we've come, he said, struggling against his suddenly treacherous voice. Of course.
God bless you, uncle.
Miriamel had always called him that, although there was no blood relation.
Bless you for waiting for us.
She fell silent, tears running down her cheeks.
How goes the high ward?
Iskrimnor asked.
Is all well?
All well, uncle,
Miriamel said.
Good. Good.
So many words seemed to tire him out. The Duke closed his eyes and for a moment only breathed, his chest rising and falling.
And Joshua? Prince Joshua? Is there any word?
Simon swallowed. The subject of Mira's uncle, their son, John Joshua's namesake, was a painful one.
I'm afraid not. We have long searched for him, his wife, for Shaver, and their children. But we can find no trace of them.
Iskrimnor shook his head.
10 years? No, 20. 20 years. I fear he must be dead after such a long time.
Simon squeezed the Duke's hand, but gently. Very gently.
We will never stop searching. I will not be here to see him found.
Iskrimnor opened his eyes again.
Simon, is that you? Tell me that is truly you. I have so many dreams lately. I scarcely know whether I am awake or not.
Yes, it's me, Iskrimnor.
The same scruffy boy you found on the frost march near St. Hodoran's long, long ago.
Iskrimnor smiled a little.
Scruffy? You rate yourself too high. I remember you as skinny and frightened as a wet cat.
His laugh became a cough, but he waved his hand to reassure them.
No, I am all right. The cough is nothing. It is the weight on my chest that is getting more difficult to bear.
He let his head sag back into the pillows.
Simon, good boy. No, I forget myself. You are king. High king.
Do you forget his wife?
Asked Miriamel, but in a tone of gentle mockery.
Never, my queen.
Iskrimnor's hand tightened on Simon's.
I ask you a favor. I ask you both. You must promise me.
Simon did not have to look at his wife to know what to answer. He used his free arm to wipe the tears from his cheeks.
Anything, Duke Iskrimnor. We owe you more than we could ever repay, as do all the kingdoms of men.
Gudrun and I were godparents to Prince Joshua's children. With Joshua and Vosheva both gone, I fear for those children.
They would no longer be children, Simon said gently. They were born the year the Storm King was defeated.
Even so.
Iskrimnor's reedy voice took on something of its infamous growl.
Is it your habit to travel so far just to interrupt a dying man?
It was hard not to smile.
Sorry, my lord duke. What would you have us do?
Find them. If you cannot find the parents, find the children. Do for them what Gudrun and I were promised to do, but failed. Find them and keep them safe. See that they have what they need for a happy life.
We have looked for them, and we will keep looking, old friend. One day, we will find them.
Iskrimnor stared at him, as though he did not know whether to believe him or not.
Do you promise it to me?
Of course, Simon told him, stung and sad.
The king looked to Miriamel.
We promise you, on the honor of our house and yours.
Gudrun would have sent me after them long ago, but her illness...
The duke shook his head.
I will see her soon, thank God and all the blessed saints. I will see her soon.
You will, uncle, said Miriamel. She is waiting for you.
And the song, too.
Iskrimnor's lip trembled.
So long since I have seen their beloved faces.
The old man's eyes were red.
So long. You are tired, father, said Grimbrand from the foot of the bed. There are others waiting to see you, but perhaps they should come back after you've rested.
Others?
Iskrimnor seemed to find a reserve of strength. With a last squeeze, he let go of Simon's hand, then Miriamel's.
What do you mean?
Other friends are waiting for you outside, Miriamel said. Count Eolair, and Binnabik and his wife.
Binnabik? The troll is here. Send him in. Send them all in.
The duke even managed to work himself up a little higher on his pillows. For the first time, Simon could truly see their old friend in the feeble, sharp-boned scarecrow stretched on the bed.
Aidan and his angels can wait for me. They will have me for a long time.
Binnabik and Siski entered first, small as children.
Behind them came Somber Aeolae, accompanied by Tiamak, whose limp always slowed him. The Rannaman stepped aside to whisper to Simon,
"I cannot find Morgan, Majesty. Binabik's daughter and her friend are looking too."
Simon had to take a deep breath to contain his temper.
"Did you check the ale halls?" "There are dozens just along the main road," Tiamak whispered.
Simon looked to his wife and shook his head, her mouth set in a thin line.
"Go and see Yskrimnor," Simon said quietly.
He patted his old friend on the shoulder, although inside the king was boiling like a pot forgotten on the fire. It was not Tiamak's fault that their grandson was a scapegrace.
"And wait, who is that?"
Iskrimnor's voice was again growing thin, his breath short, but he lifted his head high off the pillow.
"Is that Tiamak? Is that my Rannaman?"
"It is indeed Duke Iskrimnor."
Tiamak hobbled to the old man's side.
"Miriamel, come back!"
Iskrimnor lifted his hand to her.
"Come back! Look, Grimbrand, do you see the three of us?"
He nodded toward Tiamak and the queen.
"Do you see us?"
"Of course, father."
"Looking at a feeble ruin like me, you would not know it. But we three crossed half the known world. From Quanitupol across the Ran, then across all the Thrythings to the Farewell Stone, on foot. We even went down into the foul Gant's Nest together, and we came out again. There's a story, eh? That's the equal of any tale you'll ever hear, I'll wager. And Sir Camaris, the greatest warrior of any age, was with us."
"And Cadrach, too," said Miriamel. "Poor, sad, mad Cadrach."
"You were as brave as a she-wolf," Iskrimnor told her. "You were..."
He had to stop to catch his breath. He coughed for a while before he could speak again, and had to do it with his son begging him to save his breath.
"A noble tale," he said, wheezing. "Someone should make a song of it."
"Someone has," said Simon, laughing. "Several. Dozens. Good Lord, have you avoided the songs up here? I would have moved our court to Rimmersgard long ago had I known."
"The song. The song."
Iskrimnor had seemed keen to say something, but trailed off.
"What were we saying?"
"That we are together again," said Miriamel,
and bent to kiss him on his hollow cheek.
"And nobody can take those times from us."
"Bless you," said Tiamak quietly.
He was weeping unashamedly, holding Iskrimnor's hand against his face. The old man hardly seemed to notice.
I think I must sleep for a little."
"Of course," said Miriamel, straightening up. "We will come to see you later, uncle, when you are rested."
"We will be here for days," Simon said. "Never fear. There will be plenty of time for news, and old tales both."
Binnabik stroked the old man's hand, then placed his own fist against his chest, a troll gesture that Simon knew signified all that was in the troll's heart. Siski bowed her head. Then the two of them turned and walked out of the room. Aeolae was next. He kneeled beside the bed and kissed the Duke's hand.
"It is good to see you, my lord,"
was all he said, before he too rose and went out. Simon was about to bid the old man good night, when he saw a familiar face in the antechamber beyond.
"Morgan,"
he said in a loud whisper.
"Come here."
Our grandson is here? Asked Miriamel. Thank God.
The prince's eyes had the look of something hunted as he entered the bedchamber.
I have been trying to find you, he said quietly,
looking at anything and everything but the old man on the bed.
This place is a maze.
This place or the Kopstader? Simon fought down his unhappiness. Just come here. Iskrimnor's eyelids had been sagging, but as Simon bent and kissed him on the cheek, he opened them again.
Simon, lad, is that you? Are you truly a king? Or did I dream all that?
He seemed to fight a little for breath.
I have so many dreams, and it all mixes together.
You did not dream it, Duke Iskrimnor. And Miriamel and I rule in large part because of you, your son Isorn, and a few other noble souls. And now, I want you to meet the heir to the high throne, Prince Morgan. I hope you will give him your blessing.
Prince Morgan?
Iskrimnor looked surprised.
You brought an infant all this way?
No. Look, uncle, said Miriamel. He is grown now.
Kneel down, boy, Simon whispered to the prince. Take his hand. Morgan looked as though he would rather be almost anywhere else in the world than this draughty bedchamber, but he reached out and enfolded the duke's crabbed, bony hand. For a moment Iskrimnor only stared at the ceiling, but then he seemed to come back to himself and looked searchingly at the heir where he knelt beside the bed.
Bless you, young man, the duke said. Do as God would have you do, and you cannot help but succeed. Listen carefully to your mother and father.
Morgan looked to his grandfather in confusion, but Simon shook his head to silence him.
Thank you, Iskrimnor, the king said.
We've done our best to make him ready.
I'm sure you've done very well, said Iskrimnor. He's a fine young man.
But the old duke's eyes had fallen closed again.
Bless you, son, he said,
his voice faint and weary. His fingers released the prince's hand.
May Osiris and the saints watch over you and keep you safe.
You are tired, Iskrimnor. Simon nodded to Morgan, who sprang up as though released from a trap. We will go now and let you rest. We have only just arrived. There will be time to talk again later. Iskrimnor's eyes half opened, looked first on Simon, then Miriamel.
Don't forget what you told me,
he said with surprising intensity.
Don't forget our godchildren, the Ornoth and Dara. It was my last promise to Gutrun, and I could not look her in the eye when we meet again. Unless I know you will work to repair my failure.
We won't forget, uncle, said Miriamel. We will never forget.
Good.
He closed his eyes again.
Good. All is good.
When they could see he was sleeping, they left him, with Grimbrand still sitting at his father's bedside. The two priests had reappeared as if by magic, and were again kneeling at the foot of the bed, murmuring the words of the exequus. Simon did not know what time it was, only that the midnight bells had rung long ago, drawing him up from sleep for a moment. He thought he had been having the dream of burning that had troubled him so many nights in the last months. but all he could remember for certain was a face made of smoke, a face that alternately wept and laughed and spoke to him in a tongue he had never heard.
"Who's there?"
He sat up, feeling for the dagger he kept at his bedside, but then remembered he was not in his own bed, not even in his own country.
"Who is it?"
"Only me, Majesty, Tiamak."
The little man came farther into the room.
"You heard me speaking to the guards. Is the queen asleep?"
Simon looked at Miriamel, who lay sprawled in the covers like an exhausted swimmer.
"She is.
Should I wake her?" "I leave it to you, Majesty,
Simon.
But I have news."
For the first time, Simon realized there was something strange about Tiamak's voice.
"What news?"
But Tiamak had been crying again, and Simon thought he knew.
"Duke Escrimnor, that good old man, he died an hour ago. His son has just told me. Forgive me for disturbing you, but I thought you would want to know. I thank she who waits to take all back that we were in time to see him once more."
Tiamak went out. Simon looked at his sleeping wife. Suddenly, the weight of the great old castle around him, of Rimmersgard itself, foreign, and yet a part of him, as well as the expectations and fears of all their subjects in all the lands, seemed like a weight too heavy to bear. Even with Miriamel only inches away, Simon felt more lonely than he had felt in many years. He wondered if he would ever sleep well again, this side of the grave. Perhaps those who had gone on, like Escrimnor, were to be envied after all. 9. Heart of the Kinswood. Lord Chancellor Passivalis had spent most of his morning listening to a group of fat, wealthy merchants complaining about Countess Ysola of Padruin and her attempts to wrest control of shipping in Erkinlandish waters back from the Northern Alliance. To hear the merchants speak, the lady was part demon, part pirate, and the worst parts of both. He had done everything he could to mollify these men, but what they really seemed to want was to complain, as they had been doing for a long time, and clearly intended to continue doing. Passivalis was trying to look interested, whatever mayhem he might have been privately contemplating, when the messenger from the Niarulla Gate guardhouse found him. The merchants didn't stop talking even when Passivalis leaned aside to listen to the guardsman, and might not have noticed his divided attention if he had not loudly interrupted them.
"I'm sorry, my lords, but something very important has come up. I must leave you, but I promise that your concerns will all be relayed to the king and queen."
"We do not merely want our concerns relayed, Lord Chancellor," said the fattest merchant of all, Baron Tostig, who had bought his title from a distressed landowner with the profits of a lucrative trade in wool and hides.
"We want the High Throne to do something."
"And so the High Throne shall, I'm sure, but not before the King and Queen return to Erkinland."
It was hard to keep patience with men like these, creatures intent only on their own ledger books and never on any larger issues. But Passivalis had been well schooled in patience, long before he had agreed to act as Hand of the Throne, while Count Eolair travelled with the King and Queen.
"But I told you the truth, my lords. I am needed. Father Wibert, will you show the gentleman out?"
As his secretary rounded up the herd of merchants, most of them still bitterly advertising their grievances, Passivalis hurried to find his cloak. He made his way across the inner keep to the stables and borrowed one of the post horses, fresh and already saddled. Only moments later he was riding out through the Nearola gate, where the Erking Guard all gave him vigorous salutes. The Chancellor was well liked by the guardsmen, who knew he had taken their side when Duke Osric, the Lord Constable, would have reduced their numbers. He cantered down Main Row, through the city, and out into the warren of streets that had sprung up there with the growth of Urchester. He could not help being impressed by the way the place had changed, just during his time at the Hayholt. 20 years earlier, Urchester had ended at the city walls, but today it sprawled far beyond them, with buildings both ramshackle and surprisingly well-made, standing shoulder to shoulder, all across Swertcliff. Although most of the roads were little more than well-worn tracks, still muddy from the winter rains. When Passavalles had arrived some years after the Storm King's War, no more than 10,000 people had lived in the castle and town, despite it being the capital of all Osten-Ard. He felt sure that today there must be at least 5 times that many. Someday in the not-too-distant future, the new residents outside the city proper would demand the protection of their own wall. The only place in the outer city where houses were not squeezed higgledy-piggledy along the walls, like mushrooms, was on the western side, where the royal forest called the Kinswood lay stretched like a sleeping beast. It was becoming harder every year to keep the forest safe from Urchester's growing population. Not just to keep a few deer for the king's and queen's table, but to prevent the wholesale cutting of trees for timber, since the Kinswood was a great deal closer than the mighty Alde Orte. Only the previous autumn, the king and queen had been compelled to double the number of royal foresters, and even so, King Simon hadn't liked it much. "But what if a man is starving?" he had asked. "Should he be hung for trapping a hare?"
"If starving men know they can find a meal in the royal forest," the queen had told him, "then there will soon be no hare in the forest, or deer, or boar, or anything."
The king and queen made an interesting pair, Passavalles thought, seemingly as different as husband and wife could be. Simon was proud of his lowly birth and upbringing, and if given his way would have spent most of his time in the stables or the kitchens, gossiping with the servants. But the queen had been born to the old royal house, and was comfortable with most of the privileges of wealth and noble blood. She was also very fierce about protecting what she felt was right. When she sat in judgment, she was fair-minded, but in no way the soft touch for a sad story that her husband was. Once he was beyond the outermost neighborhoods of Urchester, Passavalles guided his mount off the Kinswood Road and down into the trees. He knew his secretary Wibbert would be furious when he learned that the Lord Chancellor had gone outside the city without guards. But there were times when Passavalles did not want to wait, and this was one of them. It was not easy to find the spot, but at last he saw a flash of red and white through the trees below him. The 2 rampant dragons, emblem of the royal house. He tied his horse to a branch and made his way down the slope. A pair of Erking guards and a royal forester with a feather in his cap were waiting with a 4th man, a thin fellow in a ragged jerkin, who looked as though he had been sleeping rough for some time.
"Don't hang me, my lord,"
the thin man squealed as Passavalles finally reached them.
"I only found it. I never did nothing."
Passavalles could see the unmistakable shape of a human body, half buried in the leaves at their feet. He turned to the man with the feather.
"Your name, forester? Then tell me what has happened here."
The forester had the lean, weathered look of one who, had he not been given this post, might have been poaching with the man begging for his life.
"Nathan am I, Lord Chancellor. My lad and I were on our rounds when this fellow ran out, screaming like the white foxes had come back. Said there was a dead un in the woods. A woman. Was he carrying anything? Any game?"
"I weren't,"
cried the ragged man, bursting into tears.
"I were only lost."
Passavalles knew better, but he waited for the forester's reply.
"No, lord, his hands were empty. His bag, too. The steward turned to the weeping man. And what is your name? Be truthful, or I will know it, and things will go hard for you.
Dragon, Lord, but I done nothing wrong. I swear on St. Sutrin's holy name.
Passavalles shook his head. You may go, but I hope I never hear your name again, Dragon. And if you are caught in the royal forest again, well, you may wish we had hanged you. The ragged man got to his feet with many cries of gratitude, then ran back up the hill toward Urchester. The Erkin guards watched him go with the sulky expressions of dogs denied a chase.
Begging your pardon, Lord, but you know he was in these woods for only one thing, said the forester, Nathan.
Of course. But if we'd beaten him, he'd be back in a few nights. As it is, he has told me his name. That will give him pause a bit longer.
Passavalles stepped closer to the body, then sank to his knees beside it.
So, he brought you to see this.
Then what happened?
I sent my boy to fetch the guards.
And we sent a messenger to you, Lord Chancellor,
said one of the Erkin guardsmen, almost proudly.
Fine. You all did as you should.
He leaned closer, brushing away the damp leaves that clung to the body. He could see a little less than half of the face, but that was strange enough. Thin and high-boned, and less pale than he would have imagined. What was stranger was that he could see no other sign of decay, despite the body likely having been in place for days, at least by the amount of forest debris that covered it. The corpse looked to be a woman's.
I don't see any sign of what, he began.
Then the royal forester jumped and swore behind him.
That eye, he said. It twitched. I saw it.
He took a few stumbling steps back.
Don't be foolish, Passavalles began.
Then he saw it too, the faintest tremor in the exposed eyelid. His heart jumped a little in his chest.
Merciful Aidan, I apologize. You are right.
There was only one thing to do. Passavalles began to dig away the mulch that covered her. After a moment, the Erkin guards got down beside him to help, although the forester stayed a careful distance away. When they had uncovered her completely, one of the guardsmen made the sign of the tree on his breast. The other stared for a moment, then did the same.
Is it a fairy, my lord?
The second guard asked.
A cither, you mean? Or a norn?
Passavalles sighed. He had half anticipated something like this, ever since the king and queen had set out for Rimmer's Guard. Some major crisis that would push aside the things he had planned to do during their absence.
I guess that she is Scythi, although I have never met one myself.
He took the soiled cloth of her sleeve in his fingers, and felt its smooth weave, slippery as Southern Island silk. Now that she was uncovered, he could see a shallow movement of her chest.
God save us! She still breathes! Help me!
He rolled her onto her side and sucked in his breath at the sight of three broken arrows that had pierced her, as well as all the dried blood they had let out of her slender body.
Quick, he told the forester. Run to the city and find someone with sailcloth or a heavy blanket, something we can use to carry her, and have a cart ready when we get her up to the top.
Carry her where, my lord?
Asked one of the guards as the forester scrambled away up the slope.
Back to the Hayholt. It's our misfortune that Master Tiamak is with the king and queen. But I will find someone to take care of her.
Did she say anything, make any sound that you heard?
No. We thought she was dead, my lord.
And so she should be.
Any mortal would have died from those wounds long ago.
Princess Lilia was waiting for him in the outer throne hall when he pushed through the doors from the garden court.
I heard the noon bell a very long time ago, the girl said. You didn't tell the truth. You said you would tell me a story when noon came, and I've been waiting and waiting.
I am so very sorry, Highness. Passavalles held the door for the guards and their burden. But we found this woman sick in the forest, and I must help her. Do you know where